afternoon. I could see Holger didn't answer, so we have to do that again. Good afternoon. It's wonderful. We had you standing for lunch. It's because you're sitting all day, of course, but it's also because it was the easiest way for us to do lunch today. We are heading into the afternoon session, and I am before we do going into the next session, I would just remind you how interesting and rich the discussions are. Why am I saying this? I'm saying this so you stay to your allotted time, please, because we also want the discussions. Very important. So the next session is on augmented reality, virtual reality, and AI in delivering skills for STEM and innovation. Moderating that will be Rebecca Gregory Clark. She's head of technology at Immersive of Digital Catapult. Welcome.
Thanks. Thank you. I get a badge. That's a bonus I wasn't expecting. All right. Thank you very much. Okay, so this session, we have an hour for this, and we're going to be talking about the role of emerging technology in delivering skills for science and innovation, and particularly focusing on virtual augmented reality and AI. At Digital Catapult, which some of you may know is a UK government-backed innovation agency, we work with a whole range of different companies of different kinds to try and accelerate their use of digital technology, and I focus on virtual and augmented reality. And we're seeing actually a lot of interest at the moment in this particular area, in delivery of skills and training. It's a real growth area. And just to give you a flavour of the kind of things we get asked about a lot, we get asked about if it could be used in, for example, delivering training in hazardous environments, safer training environments. Could it be used as part of a data visualisation technique for interrogating complex data sets, particularly where there's an element of spatial awareness or something like that involved, all the way through to softer skills as well. So this includes things like training for public speaking, like I'm doing now, or even dealing with complex social situations. So it's a really broad bucket. And then on the AI side as well, we're starting to see lots of interesting examples of how it might be used to create more scalable training solutions or more personal education solutions as well. I'm particularly interested in where those two things converge, actually, AI, VR, and AR. So perhaps I think we're going to hear a bit about that later. So I'm delighted to say that we are going to be joined by three experts. Hopefully we'll get the discussion going just after past and leave a lot of time for all of your questions. So without further delay, I'd like to invite Emery Craig to the stage. Emery is the Director of E-Learning at the College of New Rochelle in New York, and he's going to give an overview of his recent experience and some near-term possibilities of delivering STEM education using VR and AR, as well as the role of AR in transforming immersive environments.
Oh, okay. Thank you very much. I'm the lucky one who got to draw the first talk after lunch, okay? And you're all such a quiet, passive group, so I'll see what I can do to liven things up a little bit. I also talk very fast. I live in the middle of New York City, so right now I am talking in slow motion, all right? So just slow it down later on if you needed to. I want to thank the invitation from OECD to be here and the incredibly important work that they are doing in so many areas here, and particularly these are the kinds of conversations that we need to have. So today, in the short amount of time that I have, I want to explore some of the remarkable developments in the use of augmented and virtual reality, but I also want to examine some of the challenges that we're going to face in the future and the importance of shaping policy in this area. And does this work? Yes, it does. Okay, good. We are on the cusp of a new era in technology change. After a long winter in VR, and some of you know it was a really long, quiet winter with not much happening, we have had a resurgence in the past 5 years ago, and in that past 5 years, I've been very much part of that in addition to my work at the College of New Rochelle. I also co-founded a research and consulting group, Digital Bodies, that works on VR and AR, particularly in the educational environment, but also for nonprofits and other organizations. I would actually argue that what is happening is we are on the cusp of exiting the age of information that we have been in and entering a new experiential era. It's an age that it will let us step virtually into any environment, at any time, with anyone, from any place. It will take care of web conferencing, that I can tell you, but a lot more. It will bring about a revolution in learning, but it may also impact the role of science and knowledge in our world. So first, let's highlight some of the success stories, some of the areas where the applications are already in use. Some of you are probably aware of Labster, which is a program that provides virtual science simulations. Students enter a lab, they follow the same protocols they would in a real lab. Some of the experiments actually have storylines which engage students. Your professor has died, been killed. You have to provide the forensic evidence to... That gets them engaged, right? It's hard for them to ignore that, right? You know, they ignore everything else, but not that. Students can also create their own simulations. They can test out hypothesis and communicate the research. In the U.S., Arizona State University recently implemented a fully online biology degree. And this is at least the first time in the States that something has been done like this, and I think it has global implications for STEM education. Children's Hospital in Los Angeles, absolutely fascinating what they've done. They've basically recreated a virtual trauma center, all the elements of a real setting. There are virtual doctors and nurses barking orders, rushing around. There are distraught parents standing too close to you saying, save my child, or don't even do that to my child. Everything that you would have in the environment. So it's not just the virtual patient on the table. It is the whole atmosphere. And students are able to then react to this. The program monitors what they do. It responds to them. And it basically recreates the entire environment there. And that's a powerful development for learning. The Virtual Engineering Center at the University of Liverpool provides training, research, and knowledge transfer through simulation, modeling, and 3D immersive visualizations. These 3D walls are amazing installations, and they're still very expensive, but they're going to come down in price over time. And there's variants of these all around. George Lucas in the IMLX Labs has been using one called HoloCinema, not for science work, but actually for storytelling. And I did this at Sundance the other year at the Film Festival. And it's utterly amazing when you stand in this space and all of a sudden the digital characters come up and stand there at the wall and then step out into the space with you. Or you wonder, are you stepping into the space with them? And it's just an incredible development. Finally, at JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory at NASA, science and engineer and researchers are using Microsoft HoloLens mixed reality headset and the on-site platform to teleport to Mars and actually walk on an accurate reproduction of the surface. They actually use this for determining where the rover will be moving next, and also in terms of working with each other. While right now this is only available to a limited number of researchers in the U.S. and in Europe, on-site will soon have a public version of this where other users can collaborate on work remotely. And scientific work and other work. What we need to consider here, of course, is that these innovations will not stay confined to universities and research centers. As the technology becomes less expensive to use, it will spread into the public arena. That bodes well for public access to scientific events. Elon Musk, CEO of SpaceX, has already promised that the 2023 moon mission will be live stream in high-definition VR. Kind of interesting, particularly since we don't have broadband in space right now, but he promises that we will soon have broadband in space because the Starlink satellite system plans on launching 3,500 communication devices over the next 3 to 4 years, so that there will be a high-def live stream coming back to us. This, of course, obviously makes space travel more accessible, opens up new opportunities for citizen science work. We've already seen some incredibly creative collaborations between artists and scientists, as in Eliza McNitt's Spheres, Songs of Space-Time, VR Experience, which won the Grand Prix in VR at Venice Film Festival. It's a virtual experience of one of the deepest mysteries of the cosmos, black holes. and you step into this and you're drawn closer and closer to a black hole until eventually you are sucked into it and torn apart. What astrophysicists like to call spaghettification. You are turned into a stream of light, which is it's an interesting concept, I know, kind of hard to get across. But the experience takes an unexpected turn because as this happens and you're sucked into this, first you were a victim of it and then you turn around and start drawing other stuff into it after you, other stars into you, other stars into the black hole. So first you're the victim and then you become the protagonist. Augmented reality, likewise, we're going to see major developments here. The New York Times had a recent AR experience that came out at the end of October in the United States for Halloween. It was specially done for children, but is actually for everybody. It explores the hundreds of thousands of parasites, mites, and microscopic organisms that live on your body and around your body. And you, of course, have a whole community of, you know, you co-live, co-work all the time. You just don't realize it. And they come to life in AR on the web and through an AR application. Give it 2 more years, we will have AR in our glasses, probably 2020, something like that. And once that happens, of course, all this is going to take off and just simply explode. So these developments take place both in and outside the educational sector, but they also raise future challenges that policymakers need to address. Immersive technologies are already showing up in popular culture, of all places in the United States, on the Weather Channel. I don't think of them as the most innovative place to go, but nonetheless, you know, because their programming's pretty boring, okay? It's like, it is, you know exactly what you're going to get. But they've been fairly amazing in what they're doing. They're actually doing mixed reality, where they have the meteorologists on stage and then throw in the digital artifacts that are either behind him or her or even in front, occluded by the person or occluding the person. What's fascinating about this is that they're not doing any post-editing in this. This is all done live. 2 years ago, you could never have done something like this as a live event. It is absolutely astonishing in terms of this. Our VR content creation tools, of course, are going to become so much easier to use. Take a look at something like the Disney Research Project Cardinal, which can take text and turn it into a VR experience. This is at the most basic level right now, and Disney's working on this basically for storyboarding, not for any other reason for that. But down the road, you can see where this is headed. What's going to happen is that we'll be able to, at some point, anybody will be able to do any VR experience. Stop and think for a moment of the implications of this. What if people could do an immersive simulation as easily as they could do a Facebook post right now? We will reach that point within 5 years, I promise you, okay? What that means, of course, is the STEM experiences that we see now in the New York Times or by responsible artists and scientists will be done by anyone. You've already seen what's happened to the news media with social media and fake news. And will the same thing happen to science? Will its authenticity be called into question through the democratization of these technologies? Michael Medry has his own take on this, and he says that any amateur user will be able to generate an avatar that looks like anybody on Earth or anyone that's ever lived in and animate the avatar to do whatever they like. And we might be able to do the same with any scientific simulation also. This is where, of course, you know, it fits back into the stuff earlier on this morning that we talked about. Does blockchain provide a possible solution to this, the tokenization of scientific experiments and events, that some guarantee of authenticity? Because otherwise, we're going to be in this world of competing simulations. What happens in VR, of course, is as the first media form that doesn't require a suspension of disbelief, like traditional media. In virtual experiences, you are the central character. There is no theoretical distance from it. It happens to us. Every virtual experience, well done, is eminently believable. It's when the experience is over that we have to remind ourselves that it isn't real. So this raises a profound challenge not only for education, but I think for all areas, which is that of digital literacy or digital fluency. which largely remains focused up to this point on textual resources. There's various definitions of media literacy, which might serve as a basis for this. The European Commission Expert Group on Media Literacy in 2016 defined it as technical, cognitive, social, civic, and creative capacities that allow a citizen to access and have a critical understanding of media and interact with it. Ofcom in the UK took a simpler approach and just said the ability to use, understand, and create media and communications in a variety of contexts. But what both of these definitions miss is it's not just media. It's an experience, and we have no understanding. We have no framework right now for an experiential literacy. I am ever the optimist here. I grew up in the Midwest of America, okay? On the other hand, every now and then I think back to Freud's comment to Einstein on the eve of World War II, where he says, you know, the mills grind so slowly that, yes, the flowers produce, but the citizens still starve to death. And I know the mills are grinding in education. I'm just not sure that they're grinding fast enough at the moment. The innovation needs to happen at a much faster pace. One final challenge here, of course, is foveated rendering, the technical issue in immersive experiences in VR headset. Foveated rendering is when basically the VR headset renders as your eyes do, which we only focus on a very small part that is high def. Everything else around us gets blurred out, and our brain, of course, puts that together. If we could do foveated rendering in VR, we would only use 1/20th of the pixels we are currently doing. Right now, we waste pixels. We throw all these pixels into a VR headset, but we don't need them all, okay? They're just wasted because our eyes don't have the peripheral vision like that. If you look at, let me back up, hold on. If you look at foveated rendering as it was done in 2017, this is a good example of it. The center of the picture is in high def. All the surrounding area is pixelized, but it's not pixelized for us. It's blurred out in another way. And this is what is remarkable. What Facebook did just a couple months back at the Oculus Connect conference, when they showed an example of foveated rendering that is using AI. The area in the red circle is the high def area, the area that someone is looking at. And as one is looking at that, that is what is rendered in high def. Everything else on a screen is rendered through AI, not through pixels being pushed into the screen, either wirelessly or through a wired connection. So that, of course, makes you wonder, what are the implications of this, of using AI to generate our immersive experiences? As these technologies converge, I would even ask down the road if we would need to measure our silicon processors not by their speed and power, but by the degree of autonomy that they reserve for human experience and thought. This development also raises profound issues in terms of privacy, eye tracking. If you're going to do foveated rendering, you have to know where somebody's looking. If you know where someone's looking, you've got a whole bunch of data that we do not have right now. And if you look at the original terms of agreement for the Oculus Rift, it was wide open. It could monitor where you were looking, could monitor your body movements, everything. It still does, but Facebook says now the information has been de-identified, which is very reassuring until some programmer steps up and says, oh, I have that data, as Cambridge Analytica did, okay? So you never know where this is going here in terms of this. And that is something that policymakers are going to have to address. And if you've ever viewed a 360 video from a retailer on YouTube, there's a good chance that there's not eye tracking, but mouse tracking going on in the background, and or head tracking if you've done it inside a headset. So all of this, of course, raises some serious questions for policymakers. How will we redesign our learning experiences and our educational institutions in light of immersive technology developments? How will the popularization of immersive content creation tools affect the role and the validity of science? Are we going to end up with competing simulations? No, this is climate change. No, this is not climate change. How should we define digital literacy in a world of ubiquitous immersive experiences? And finally, what is the impact on our cognitive abilities and our social behaviors when AI begins to render our immersive simulations? These developments bring significant challenges for educational policy, institutional practice, and, as always, our social norms. But in raising them, I still remain deeply confident about the future. And I think that Europe in particular, as a strong, competitive VR hub with a diverse range of perspectives, is in a unique position to try to solve these problems. I think that it can lead the way because we are entering an era where the boundaries between the real and the virtual are beginning to dissolve and probably within 10 years could possibly vanish completely. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that. Okay, next up we have Julien Chiaroni, who is the Deputy Director in charge of Programs and Strategy at CEA Tech List in France. And Julien is going to talk to us about uses of VR, AR and AI in training for industry, including developments in haptic technology.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So, hello everyone, I'm Julien, I'm from the CEA List. I will tell you later on what does the list mean. But first of all, I would like to thank the organizer for the conference and also to give me the opportunity to tell you a short story about digital technologies. So, all digital technologies can be used to develop some new skills and so new educational content also. In a various sector and especially in industry. So, So obviously we are moving from the first to the fourth industrial revolution, and and it's really clear that now you are using digital technology to connect everything, to connect factories, to connect people, to connect robots. And what is really important is how people can develop some new training, to some new skills to use the digital tech inside the industry, but also how you can use the digital tech to develop some new skills and some new educational content also to help them working and develop some new skills, what is really important for the future of the industries. We are trying to accomplish that. So we are accelerate deployment of new technologies. We are also involved in value chains. And we are also developed and demonstrate flexible, agile, and production systems. But what is really important, we are trying to keep human inside the system. So everything what we're developing is really dedicated to people, to students, and to help them to develop some new skills. And it's really important to develop some new tech which are really user-centric, because at the end, they will use it. And we can see that in this slide, it's a slide coming from Capgemini. It's a study of impact of VR and AR technologies inside the industries. It's not tomorrow, it's already there. So lots of industry using VR and AR technologies to help people to train them inside their job. And it's really important. We can see some difference between some of their country, but we have one experiment and one implementation also, and it's already there. But Technology is really available now. We can deal with artificial intelligence, with VR, AR, with robotics. But what is really important, the technology itself is not really useful. You have to develop some new solution. And to develop this new solution, you have to combine each or several of these technology together inside the technical integration to develop some new system. And it allows you to develop some new skill for digital worlds, yeah. Obviously, but it also allows you to develop a new way for training in all sectors. You can adapt to the needs, you can be user-centric also, and you can develop some new strategy, new educational and new content strategies to be sure that your solution is really specific and dedicated to the need of the people. So what does a list mean? It's really what we've done. We are developing a list, it means laboratories with the S, for integration of system and technology. So it means that we are developing technologies and we are integrate them inside the system approach. And we are developing a high level of technologies, of basic brick, what we call, and we integrate them inside the solution. And what is really important is that to develop a system approach which combines software and hardware approach, and also to be sure that the system you develop is really safe and secure. So we are dealing with advanced manufacturing, embedded system, and also, but I will skip this one. And we are working with several companies, but it's not really important, this one. What is really important, in all sectors, we are working with companies that we are developing them some technology we are really dedicated for training and educational approach inside the company. So, for example, in aeronautics, in automotive industry also, they ask us to develop some new tech for training. It could be for engineering also, it could be for students, and it could be for worker also. And I will show you some few examples. But it's not working. Oh, sorry. No. No. So, for example, what is really interesting is that we are developing some really immersive solution, and it could be used in automotive industries to develop some new solution to help people to be trained and do the painting correctly. And it's really important because it's cost effective, because you cannot stop a production line to train some people. So as we develop some virtual environments which are really close to the reality, we can show them what is really the good solution, how they can do, and how they can use the technologies to be sure that the movement is really clear and really close to that they have to do. This one is a solution for offshore training. So, for example, it's really hard to be trained in a critical environment. When you have some students, for example, they have to be trained in a critical environment. So it's not possible to bring the people and to go and bring them to the offshore system. So you have to develop some real and digital twin, which are really close to the reality. So it means that you are able to do some simulation, and you are, for example, able to be sure that the movement of the people is really close to the reality, and also to be sure that you can include all the parameters inside the simulation to be sure that it's really close to the reality. So it means that, for example, in this case, you have to be sure that you have the movement of the sea, you need to feel the weight also of the system. So with some haptic approach and haptic technology, you have to be sure to develop some new solutions that can be really in a realistic environment. So this one, it's a startup. They are doing this. It's a startup in virtual reality. And for this example, it's a way to train some people to design some factories. So to be sure to design some factory, you have to perform some tests, and to perform some tests, it's really cost effective in a realistic. It's really it's really cost effective to do in a virtual environment, and so you are able to develop this kind of solution. So you can try to simulate the collaboration between the robot and the operators, for example, and after you can combine all the elements together to be sure that the line of production is really effective and is really close to what you want at the end, and you can also optimize the production line. So you can test everything inside the production line and after the student can be easily in a real configuration which is close to the reality. What is really important also is to provide some knowledge directly to the people when you are training them. And one of the ways is also to use augmented reality. So for this case, it's a projected augmented reality, and you can, thanks to this solution, you can provide the information directly to the people when you are train them. And it's really important because it's really provide information at the moment they want the information. So, for example, it's a development done in a naval with the naval companies, and it's a kind of assistant at the workplace with all the configuration you need. So it's really important because it's really cost in terms of cognitive flexibility for the people. It's really useful, because they just have the information at the right place at the right moment. Just stand the video. And my last example is the digital twin, because we have a school also which is dedicated to the training of engineering training for nuclear power plant. And for example, when you have to train engineer in different scenario, for example, in a power plant, it's really difficult to access to a critical environment. So with this kind of solution, you have a nuclear plant, and you can have a digital twin of the nuclear plant. It's a project which is called EVOCT. And we are really able to simulate everything inside the nuclear plant. And we are developing a multimodal platform. And so the students, the engineering students, are coming to the platform, and they can trade to different scenarios. And it's really useful because it's not possible to access to this kind of environment. And when you want to develop such a skill, you have to practice. And if you want to practice, you cannot do it without any access and without any scenarios, for example. So in this case, we have developing this platform. It's a really complete immersive solution. And this platform is all in virtual reality, and we can project some scenarios inside the platform, and you can see how the student can react, function of the different parameters, and it's everything simulated with one of our software architecture, which is based on one of our platform, which is XDE for simulation. And before that, to do the simulation, we are a stereo movie of one of the facilities. So it's really something which are combining a physical solution, a physical infrastructure with a virtual infrastructure. And it's really a huge project because it's 1 or 2 years of investment for this one. But at the end, all the people trained inside this school, which is related to, which is a school dedicated to nuclear engineering, all students can access to these facilities to develop their skills, to learn about how a nuclear power plant is running, to develop all the skills and know how to react in case of problem or something. And this project was presented to the World Nuclear Exhibition in 2018. And it's the first platform. In a nuclear engineering school. What really is important for the policy? I think that the French government launched a new initiative in France, which is called Plan 10,000 Formation. So it's really a way to be sure that you can bring together all the participants, industry, school, and R&D center to be all together and develop some new educational content and new educational solution and technology also to train people and to help them to develop new skills in digital technologies, to be sure that there will be there will be hiring in industry. But sorry, it's also a way to be sure that you will develop some new data based on educational, and because it's really important to when you want to do some simulation and virtual reality or augmented reality, one of the key challenges is really to have some contents. It's really easy inside industry because you have some process and you can include process inside your simulation. But when you are developing some new solution for educational, you have to develop some new content for that. And it's also one of the goals of this initiative in France. And it's also a way to have a database of educational content for virtual reality and simulation also. So it's a new plant. It was launched in 2018, I think. So thank you.
Thank you, Julien. And lastly, I'd like to invite Marty Lowe, Professor and Director of the Learning Media Design Centre at the Human Computer Interaction Institute at Carnegie Mellon University.
Do I have to do something to bring it up? Oh, there it goes. All right. I guess I don't need to introduce myself. First, I want to thank the OECD and Oslo Metropolitan for pulling us together and inviting me. This is a real privilege to be able to spend 2 days with incredibly thought-provoking talks. A little bit about me. I'm a design-based researcher and faculty at the Human Computer Interaction Institute, and the center I direct really looks at developing new kinds of mediated STEM learning experiences, and primarily for informal science education experiences. And so I just want to say a few words about what we mean about informal science education. This is a graphic that's frequently shown at many of the meetings I'm at. It's often to sort of make the point to funders and educational researchers and policymakers that we focus a lot of our funding and attention on the orange space. This is the formal education system. Really, if you look at the waking hours that a youth spends over the course of their kind of K-12 or 5 to 18 year, only 18.5% of that time is spent in school. And so there's this tremendous opportunity to think about how learning and instruction takes place in this big deep blue sea. And that's where I spend a lot of my time thinking about designing those kinds of learning experiences. And we know from the research that interest, motivation, culturally relevant exposure to science happens in these out-of-school, after-schools, museum, kind of community-based learning opportunities. And so thinking about that as a place to think about the STEM engagement and STEM literacy is an important consideration. So many of you are familiar with this interface. This is Google Maps, and I used this morning to come over. And I just want to point out some features of this platform, because I think it's kind of a phenomenal integration of multiple kinds of information. I'm just going to read this so I capture all of them. It allows us multiple interconnected views that allows us to toggle between satellite imagery and map views that seamlessly connect to county, city, and road maps through deep zoom. And from top down, you can switch these panoramic 360 street views, and you get real-time traffic conditions, route planning by foot, car, bicycle, or public transportation, and it affords inputs for crowdsourced locations and annotations with comments, reviews, and ratings. I mean, that's kind of an amazing platform when you think about it, right? And why doesn't this exist for science communication, science learning? And so my group has been working on using the kind of pyramid tiling scheme. So this is a little bit like that foveated rendering that Emery was mentioning, this ability to seamlessly be able to deliver kind of dynamic experiences through rich, high-resolution image spaces. So we've been playing with that for a couple years. I'm sorry, I'm using multiple things here. And I'm going to talk about how we've explored this particular technology across three models of public science interactions. The first model is public understanding of science. You're probably most familiar with this. This is the idea that there's expert knowledge and it needs to get translated or communicated to public audiences. It's usually a one-way transmission of knowledge. This is an example of a curator who worked at the Carnegie Museum who was doing field work in Saudi Arabia Arabia and had these beautiful high-resolution images of a petroglyph site. But it was sort of palimpsest and layered with many years of kind of graffiti overlay on it. And so her research and that sort of professional vision that an archaeologist brings to the site was something we wanted to try and communicate in the museum. And we wanted to use this annotated, explorable image as an opportunity. So I'm not going to play the video, but we were able to show, and it's not just the media itself, but it's the design and the context of it. And I think we often forget about our technologies have a context and a design. And by putting two stools and allowing for joint attention and parents and children to work together, we were able to get an average sit time of 3.5 minutes looking at rock art, which is a pretty amazing outcome. If ever you've been with children in a museum. And the other thing that's kind of interesting is thinking about the learning analytics that go along with this. It's somewhere between eye tracking and mouse clicks, right? Being able to understand how people are interrogating or inquiring a kind of an explorable image space. And so I'm going to talk about that potential in the next project I want to go over. Oh, I did not want to play that. Okay. So the next project that we moved on to working again, this was with the collections of the Carnegie Museum of Natural History and trying to understand how we could enliven and make these kind of insect collections more viable.
Okay.
We chose to look at a public participation in scientific research, which is a citizen science model of public science interactions. And the idea here is to allow more people to democratically participate in scientific research.
And I have the sound only one button away.
And so the particular area we're looking at is citizen science. And one of the bottlenecks you find
show.
In, whether it's in birding or monitoring or bioblitz
so
kind of activities,
open
is
the
taxonomic identification. Getting people to be able to accurately identify something turns out not to be that easy a thing. And it's a highly visual form of scientific observation. And I think the tools that we are currently using to sort of train and teach people how to observe with the eyes of a professional are not as like the Google Earth or the Google Maps platform. And so just to say, we do this as a co-design. I am a designer by training, and I work through a co-design process. I have my scientific collaborators, and then we work with a set of co-design partners like Trout Unlimited, Maryland Stream Waders, Pittsburgh Parks Conservancies, and they work with us through the entire design and iteration cycle. The platform that we've come up with is, again, based on this high-resolution annotated visio-spatial kind of image space. And what we've done is created a kind of an online field guide or atlas of the 150 most commonly found insects in the eastern United States. You can click into any of them. We sort of simulate being able, that first thing after you see an order or a grouping of things is to try and notice similarities and difference. We allow you to zoom in and then go to the order page. And then there's things, because we're in a digital platform, all the annotation work of starting to learn those key diagnostic characters that are often difficult to picture just off a black and white illustration or off a dichotomous key. We show those grouped together, and they're kind of labeled and annotated. And so we're doing this across the entire collection, which has multiple views, dorsal, ventral, lateral. So I could go into more detail, but the ability of this kind of taking the affordances of the field guide and looking at what we can do with the digital to use this kind of multimedia annotations to guide noticing and use sort of the verisimilitude of pictures and the kind of abstracted idealization of illustrations to help people notice similarities and differences, I think is something that's got potential across multiple different kinds of scientific and photographic observation domains. So this is the third project, and this is, this is Pittsburgh on a nice day, which, unfortunately, it's mostly like this. I want to give an example now of a public engagement in science project where we try to allow multiple people and multiple forms of expertise to come to bear on a complex socio-technical problem. The problem that a community group in Ben Avon wanted to work on was the Shenango Coke's Works. It was an old kind of a vestige of the Pittsburgh steel industry and was under an EPA degree to reduce its quenching to, I think, 7 quenches a day. And the citizens downwind of this community were pretty convinced that they were quenching more than 7 times a day, and they had their noses and had to close their windows during the summer and had lots of reports. But how are they going to make an argument to authorities? And so this gentleman started Allegheny County Clean Air Now as an action group. They partnered with the Create Lab, which is a community robotics education and technology empowerment group at the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon, who are developing these low-cost air quality sensors. They went out and worked with GAS, the Group Against Smog and Pollution, to learn how to read smoke. It turns out during a quenching, you get a slight change in opacity and a slight color change. And then a PhD student in the Create Lab went through and used a machine learning algorithm to identify all of those quenching events. And what was really the neat thing was they put together this Shenango channel, which is they took 4K surveillance cameras, positioned them at three different locations with community residents, pointing at the coke works. Then they had the smell reports. They made an app, so when you smelled something, you could locate it on the screen here. You had the Allegheny Health Department ramps, air quality data. You had the sort of low-cost air quality monitors. And then you had the sort of smoke detection event from the AI. And you could look and scrub through the video and scrub through this timeline and pop to any day in the month and look at the data. And so it was lastly mapped here so you could see air conditions or air quality conditions to see where things were flowing if there was kind of variations in time here. And so this was presented to at a regional meeting at the county Health County Department, and the EPA regional director was there. At the end of this meeting, he stood up and said, "This has to stop now." And within the year, the Shenango Coke Works was closed. I can't say it's entirely due to this project, but it was in large part allowing residents to take their local expertise and knowledge, fortify it with the arguments and the data of science, and make a really rock-solid claim that couldn't be ignored. And so I thought this is a really great example of a citizen science project, and just sort of as a feel-good, there was this recent article in the spring that asthma rates dropped 30 or ER visits for asthma dropped 35% in the neighborhood. So I want to turn now to I just didn't want to talk about my work, and I was thinking about how am I going to talk about data-driven AR and VR and AI things. And so I work at a department where those folks are all around me, and then you'd think you'd get time to meet each other, but you kind of need to use these moments to get introduced to the work. So I'm going to give you some examples. These are maybe not the leading edge examples, but they're a sampling of exemplars. And as a designer, we work kind of the knowledge, and the knowledge we produce is in the work as much as in the papers. And these kind of worked examples of the projects are something that's really important to share. And I would say for the folks that are working on scientific publishing, we need to think more richly about the tools that we have available to communicate about research projects. And we need a better taxonomy of educational technology platforms, because currently we have really weak, superficial ways of organizing these different projects. Is intelligent tutoring systems really the right grouping and category to do analysis and build on the work of the others and understand the data modeling behind it? So one of the things that I noticed in doing this work was trying to come up with what were these related to? What are the right names to be called?
All right, I'm sitting about to do an interview here at 9 o'clock.
Titles. This is Amy Ogan.
Norway,
a learning
actually,
scientist in our department who's creating this platform called Class Insight. The goal is to help teachers get more improve the feedback they get on their teaching and learning. We get a lot of TAs or first-time instructors, and they're not really given much feedback on their classroom instructional strategies. So they've used a fairly standard set of Connect type audio and video type setups where they're using computer vision and audio processing inputs to be able to track human body points, facial landmarks, and audio levels and source detections. And from these things, they can start to detect hand raises, sit-stand postures, locations and movement, gaze directions, facial affect, and talk durations and audio levels. So these are the kinds of data we can pick up. What they signify, what am I doing time-wise? Okay, how much do I have, 1 minute? Okay, I'm going to have to race through these. We work with teachers to figure out what are those kinds of analytics that they need to get feedback on. And I'll just make a quick mention. This is another form of a cognitive tutor, but put out into an exhibit kind of environment. So when you start to do hands-on play-based learning, how could we use the hints and adaptive tutoring and help people make predictions and learn about why their towers might fall or not on a shake table? So this is just another example of some of the project work going on. I'm going to go to my last slide. I'm wondering, I mean, to me, this is one of, running through a lot of these projects is human attention, right? And it's this incredible quality that we have. It's a gift that we give to each other. It's, you're giving me the gift of your attention right now. The attention on our children and our colleagues learning and work in projects is hugely vital. And so how are we cultivating these systems, this attention through the systems we're designing? And not all attention is good. My daughter can't stand my attention on her screen time, right? It's a constant source of bickering. But what I think we're not paying attention to is the digital labor and who's this gift of human attention, who's owning that and who's recording it, and how are we being intentional about who we give it to and who owns it? Because I feel like this is going to a lot of the platforms that we're working with. So, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. If I could have all of the speakers back down to the stage, you can make yourselves comfortable on one of these seats. I'm sorry, you got a bit squeezed at the end there, Marty, but hopefully we've got enough time for some questions. I would like to kick off with one, if I may. At Digital Catapult, as I said, we work with lots of different companies trying to adopt these kinds of technologies, interested in training, and there's a very interesting enthusiasm to be second to use this stuff. So first is quite risky, there's a risk that comes with that. Third is a bit slow, but they kind of want to be second, right. First to be second place. And there's lots of different reasons for that, but at least one of them that I hear again and again is there evidence that this is going to be better for me? They're waiting for some proof that it's going to be worth their while. So do these things that we've seen, the examples you've used, it can be quite easy to get your head around the idea of a pilot or, you know, this could be used, but to make that leap, is it going to improve time to competency? Is it going to save cost? What would you say the evidence base looks like at the moment? Is there evidence out there to help these companies along, or is that something maybe we could be facilitating?
First. Maybe I'll start rather than a meta level, but it's at more of a meta level. I think there's a larger issue going on in how are we going to be funding the development of high-quality educational resources. And I look to journalism as a model, right? And how are you funding the content creation? And we can get the NSF grants and then the foundation-related things to produce this educational media. But the business model and the longevity of a lot of these ed tech companies isn't there. So I think it's in some ways more of a business model question than it is just like a technology readiness thing, but that was my thought on the question.
I think obviously we're at the very early stage of this. I mean, we're at the point with the Lumiere brothers. We're in cinema. We're just getting started. And, you know, what you see now is nothing for what's going to be here 5 years down the road. There are some studies that have come out here and there. Stanford's been working on some stuff. And, I mean, clearly it seems that putting people into immersive experiences does lead to significant concrete outcomes. One of the things done at Stanford is put you in experience, and particularly students, enough of us here have gray hair, but put students in experience where they see older versions of themselves. And then they come out, and the end result of that is they decide that they're going to put more money in their retirement account than they would otherwise. University of Maryland has also done some work, too, in terms of just memorization and recall of events and sort of based on place. And that actually goes back to a Renaissance idea of reversing the notion of the theater, of putting the actors up in the audience and putting the audience person down on stage. So that you're looking out at everyone who's acting and everyone is sort of put in this location, and then you better understand what's going on because it's located all around you. And it's actually something that it's kind of like a Renaissance version of surrealist theater, if you will, absurdist theater. And there's been some good work done on that, and it seems to have very positive outcomes. But there's a lot of studies underway now and much more to come.
Okay.
So
great. Yeah. Thank you. Okay, are there any questions in the room? One down here.
Just going back to the outcomes issue, but in terms of public education rather than companies, I know that when Khan Academy was being experimented with in some of the California schools, that threw up data which was sort of counterintuitive about the difference in the ways that students learn in an online environment as compared with a paper and pencil environment. Right. Are there any experiments in using this technology in public education, in mass education, say at primary, secondary, tertiary level? And Are there any interesting observations with regard outcomes, say, in terms of lifting the performance of underachieving students as against other modes of delivering training, right, or say the right position of boys and girls in earlier stages of the educational process?
I wouldn't say that there's any large-scale projects underway. There's a number of pilot projects that are taking place in this area, and I think the initial response is very positive. We don't have the hard data yet that is still to come, but I think that we will get that down the road. But we don't really have the hard data in any kind of sort of massive. Partly because, you know, you're either doing very low-level VR of handing out Google Cardboards, or you're doing high-end VR, in which case it has been up to now super expensive, and you're going to get one or two sets, maybe a few more if you're from a well-off institution, but you're not going to have a lot, so that, you know, people are not going to have a tremendous amount of access to it right now. But I do think that it has the strong potential down to road to revolutionize learning, to boost student engagement, to foster greater gender equality on this. I mean, we do, in Digital Bodies, we do tremendous number of workshops now in public schools, which surprised us because we thought we would only be doing higher education work. And in our work in public schools, it is the young girls especially that are so fascinated by this. And I think for them, many of them see it as a way into doing something that is not exactly science, but also is not exactly just media. It seems to be a combination of both. They see a way to be incredibly creative in doing this, and, you know, a way to get into actually using technology. And the question we get all the time from them is, okay, well, what do I do? What's my next step? And, you know, it's always like, if you're serious about this, go learn Unity. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those 12-year-old girls are going, yes, I'm going to go learn Unity. And they do. You know, and that's remarkable when those kind of events happen. And then we'll go back to school 3 months later, and some young child comes up to me and she goes, guess what I did? I learned Unity. And I go, how'd you do that? YouTube. Mm-hmm. You know, but that it spurs that kind of action. Instead of seeing something as remote and distant, they actually see it. And of course, the other thing here is that kids are, I think, much more creative with the technology than adults are. Adults tend to do what we tell them to do, or older kids, you know, put the technology on kind of thing. Young kids, our experience with this has always been, okay, can I figure out a way to get the camera in the headset here? Because I want to actually do a video of what I'm doing right now. So.
Any other questions? One at the back.
Yeah. So I'm very convinced that informal learning become more and more important, and I think augmented reality, virtual reality is an important tool for that. But I'm also a bit worried that it's maybe a tool that will make us more stupid and less innovative. Mm-hmm. Because you put a lot of knowledge in these kind of systems, right? And it limits your action space if you do it wrongly. Like, you showed some very impressive videos on an oil platform, which tells me exactly how do I have assemble certain things, disassemble certain things, which basically leaves no room for me to bring in, if I do this consequently, to bring in my own creativity to improve these processes, because I just follow what the machine tells me. I think you can learn a lot with that. But I see also a certain danger that it will really limit our innovative potential that is actually within the humans. Do you have any comments on that, how to counteract that?
Yes, of course. You have to be really sure that it's a way to improve knowledge and not a way to use the human as a machine and put the knowledge inside the machine. And it's really complicated to do that. What is really important is to consider that the system is really dedicated to human. So you have to deal with these problematics, and you have to develop the system each time thinking about what the humans need. And that's, from my point of view, one of the solutions. So you have to be sure that the human is at the center of the system.
I was just going to add to that. What makes this so powerful is that in the kind of work that you're doing here is that you have the opportunity to fail.
Yeah.
If you design it right. I mean, if you design it wrong, then it becomes just follow along, do what the machine does, and you're absolutely right. I think your concerns are important. If you design it right, then you have the opportunity to do it yourself, and you learn by doing, and you can fail in a way that you could not do in real life.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. It's a way for people to practice, and to practice a lot, especially inside a critical environment. Yeah. To be sure that you are able to develop some new capabilities and skills. For example, in the project for nuclear plan, it's the only way to try and to fail. If you don't do that, when you have people inside the real situation, they cannot act because they don't know.
Yeah, you don't want failure there.
And you don't have to.
And you don't have to.
One more question at back there.
Yeah.
Yep. Hi. Can you hear me? So I spoke to an immersive company a little while ago, and they were in EdTech, face significant challenges in terms of commercialization of their products and services. And that in turn means that they are quite restricted in the creativity that they can bring to the table. Often what they found is that they were asked by an advertising agency to produce a 360 video or something along those lines. Yeah, yeah. Actually, the most interesting thing they did was off their own back an investment of money where they had a t-shirt where you could teach kids about the moving organs within a body. So you can put on the t-shirt, you can hold your phone.
The virtual reality t-shirt. Exactly.
It's a company called Curioscope. Yeah. And what my question is, I suppose to get to the point, is how do you think we can break free, and what initiatives do you think policymakers can undertake to break free of this this limitation in investment and proof of ROI for companies to invest in these technologies, so that they can have more creativity to produce game-changing experiences that can really turn the dial for young people in schools, where schools yeah. typically have very little money to spend on these sort of things, or in other training environments?
So I have a couple thoughts about that. It feels like as after any kind of disruption, if you think of an ecological model right after a hurricane or a forest fire and you wipe out all of the old growth of the healthy ecosystem, you get a lot of the early startups, right? And I feel like we have a generation of kids, or at least kids in the ecosystem right now, who are getting a lot of those early-to-market, weedy kinds of educational materials that aren't very well designed, to be honest. There's some startup with some designer who maybe talked to her teacher once and went through some weak evaluation or design research cycle, and they got an app up, and then it's getting bundled together and promoted by ed tech companies and Digital Surge and all these kind of places. And we've done some evaluation reports with schools. The schools don't have the people on staff to be knowing how to vet and evaluate the ed tech, and then the early adopter schools get the teachers that are the ones that put their hands up and raised get promoted, and the people that are more cautious in the adoption of technology, and possibly widely so because they're more seasoned teachers, it's not just that they're older, or more resistant to it. So it's just there's a broken system right now for the development and adoption of it. And I'm waiting for the day when we're going to get to a more healthy ecosystems where there's not so much, there's fewer investment and a few good bets, and that maybe is the solution. But it's kind of what's the materials that are being putting in front of our students in schools these days probably are in some ways not any better than what they were using before.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And my biggest fear here is that the ed tech vendors can co-opt this and turn this into yet another variant of what we already have. And, call it new technology once again when it ends up being nothing new. It ends up just being a replication of what we've already done. It's very important that we give teachers, and this is both the higher education and K-12, the opportunity and the support to experiment, the space to try this stuff out, to learn how to use it so that they can make informed decisions about this, because they are going to get hit by the vendors all the time. We're going to come up and say, I have the perfect solution for you. You don't have to do anything. Just let us install it in the classroom and you're done. You have immersive technology experiences, and that I don't want to see.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much, all of you.
Thank you.
We're going to leave it there.
Okay, there is no rest yet. I wasn't saying that. You said that for the wicked. Okay, straight on to the next round, which is a roundtable discussion, using digital technology to draw on collective intelligence for science and technology policy. And the moderator is Karina Antonia Hallin, head of Collective Intelligence Unit at Copenhagen Business School. Please, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much to OECD. Thank you to Oslo Metropolitan University for organizing this session on collective intelligence. Collective intelligence is an emerging research field, and it will have greater and greater impact on policy making and decision making at large. Although collective intelligence has received less attention, I would say, than AI, collective intelligence will still have the same breakthroughs as AI. And we will see a lot of cases here today. We will listen to four outstanding scholars and pioneers in the field of collective intelligence. And we will start right on because we have two online presentations. We have the father of prediction markets waiting for us online now, Associate Professor Robin Hansen at George Mason University. So welcome, Robin Hansen.
It's great to be here. I'm honored to be here. I'm going to share the screen here and give you a presentation on PowerPoint. I think you guys can all see this now. All right. So for many centuries, we have had markets where people have bought some durable commodity and paid some sort of cash for it. And there's been a price, and that price has fluctuated. And the fluctuation of that price has induced the speculators, who are people who wonder whether the price is going to go up or down, because they say to themselves, whichever way the price is going, I can turn this into a money pump. If I buy today and sell tomorrow and it goes up, I walk away with money. It's going, price is going to go down. If I sell today and buy tomorrow, I walk away with money. This is a money pump. How can I figure out which way the price is going to go? And so people have tried for centuries to find many different things that will predict which way the price might go. They ask if another price went up, if it's Monday, if it's raining. And they found things that predict the price going up. And then when they use that to make money on these markets, what they do is they reduce the pattern they see. So if the price tends to go up on Mondays and they buy on Sunday and sell on Tuesday, then the price goes up less on Mondays anymore. So the net effect of people trying to make money in these markets and trying to find patterns they can make money on is to make the pattern go away and therefore to make the current price embody a lot of information about the future price. And that's a remarkable, powerful feature of speculative markets that we've seen for centuries. Now, if we make an asset and we get people to trade it in the same way, we can use that power to produce a current price that estimates a future price. And if that future price is tied to something we control, we can make the current price be an estimate of an event that's in a future event. So, for example, if we're talking about whether Trump will win re-election in 2020, if we have an asset that pays a dollar if that happens and we get people to trade that, then the current price can be a probability estimate of that future price. And that's a powerful feature that we've seen over and over again in speculative markets and in other markets we've created. And that process can be even generalized. So if we look at the ratio of people trading dollars for an asset that says $1 if A, the ratio of that can be interpreted as the probability of A. If we have a piece of paper that says pays a dollar if A and B, now that ratio would be a probability of that joint event. If we have people trade the piece of paper that says a dollar if A and B for the piece of paper that says a dollar if A, the ratio in these trades is the ratio between the probability of A and B and A, which is the conditional probability. And so we can actually get conditional probabilities out of these markets as well as simple probabilities. And in fact, we can create assets that produce expectations. That is, if we have an asset that pays proportional to X, whatever X is, it could be the vote share of one candidate or something, then we will get a price that can be interpreted as the expectation of X, and we can even produce conditional expectations. So these are powerful features that we can use in many ways. Now, there's obvious advantages from these as mechanisms for producing estimates. They give you numerically precise numbers. You ask across a lot of different questions, you get consistent answers across them. The numbers are updated frequently. It turns out they're hard to manipulate. You don't actually have to decide who to let participate. Many people talk about this as if it was the wisdom of crowds, but it's really not about experts versus amateurs. It's just about a mechanism that entices whoever happens to know best to come in and contribute what they know. And these are all you know, nice advantages, and we have a lot of theory that says why we should expect these advantages, a theory based on incentives and self-selection. But really the thing I would mainly point you to is the empirical record. Consistently, these sort of speculative markets have either done about as well or better than an alternative in terms of accuracy. And we've had many dozens of cases over the last few decades where people have had a market like this compared to some other mechanism, be it a committee, be it a poll, and these things have done better. So I usually talk about applications to business, but now I want to talk about science. And I wrote a paper in 1989 called Could Gambling Save Science? And 5 years later, when the web was getting started, some people made a website called Ideosphere now that started in 1994, so it's almost 25 years old now, and they put up science questions. And now many of those questions have been going for 25 years. And you can look it up. The activity is relatively low, but it shows that it's possible to create betting markets on science questions because it's been going for a long time. I was part of a project called SciCast in 2014. It was a follow-on to a different related, closely related project. And we created 1,200 questions on various science topics and had, you know, a great many participants trading them. And we had an interface like this where you could, you know, choose as if it was a poll, or we had a slider interface where you could set a number by sliding a bar. And we actually had a combinatorial system, which was the research focus of this topic, where these 1,000 questions were connected in a Bayesian network such that when you updated one of them, that propagated through the network to update all the rest of them, and that people could do those conditional expectation and conditional probability trades in this market. And we showed in some experiments that we did some financial incentives on some parts of it and showed that made a difference in improved accuracy. Here's a concrete example from the last presidential race, 2016 race. There were markets up where you could bet on the U.S. presidential candidates, whether they'd be nominated and whether they'd win. And if you think about it, you realize that the ratio of those two is the chance they will win if they're nominated. And so these markets actually implicitly gave the political parties advice about who to nominate, because they said, here's the chance if you nominate this person that they will actually win the election. And that's an example of using conditional markets to make decision advice. And that's a key thing that science could use. So I just want to go through now a number of ways that science and academia could use prediction markets if they wanted to. And then we'll talk about some of the obstacles and perhaps reasons why this won't happen. But as with the Ideosphere market or the other markets, we can definitely have markets just on particular scientific questions. What will the consensus eventually be, say, on whether dark matter is mostly axions? We could estimate some number like the mass of a neutrino. We could address social science questions. I'm an economist, and we could address questions like, if we adopted a school voucher program in some district, would that increase student test scores overall or not? We could even go so far as to admit particular students on the basis of markets about how well that student will do if they are admitted to the school. As you may have heard, there have been some markets recently set up to estimate whether particular psychology experiments would replicate. And those experiments, the markets did a good job, as well as polls also did a good job of estimating which experiments would in fact replicate. And so when a article is submitted to a journal, you might even have a market like this set up. And I'm actually part of a project that's trying to do that now. It's a larger extension of that previous project to have journals, when they have a submission, ask a market, what's the chance that this experiment would replicate? Also do that for theory papers. You could ask, what's the chance, if people search and look carefully for proof errors, that they will find them, especially if that was incentivized somehow. A journal could, in addition to asking whether an experiment would replicate, they could ask, well, how many citations will this article get if we publish this in our journal? You know, whatever outcome measure the journal's interested, what's the chance there'll be a Nobel Prize on the basis of this article, et cetera. You could choose who to hire at an institution based on citations or award probabilities or whatever, or just the chance you'll give them tenure. Scientific organizations, academic organizations, could use these markets to evaluate particular people's suitability for particular jobs. You could even, if you had a grant and you had some outcome that you cared about for grants, say it was the Department of Energy and they wanted to know what's the energy efficiency that some device would produce if you had let them work on it, then you could evaluate grant applications on the basis of the chance or the expected outcomes that they might produce. So I hope this, you know, makes it clear there's an enormous potential range of applications for these sorts of markets in science if people were interested in trying them. That's the key question. Do people actually want to allow these sorts of markets to have this sort of influence on these markets? But again, we have this enormous empirical literature saying that these things are really quite accurate and they beat basically or tie any other institution you put them up against. So in general, for these applications, what you need are just a small number of things. There are some technical questions about how you structure the markets, but it's just too easy to get distracted by that. The key thing you need is you actually have to have questions you want to answer. Too many organizations put up these markets and didn't really care about the answer, and then they quit. You need to have people who might be able to answer the questions. They don't have to, don't have to be sure of that, but you have to be able to give them some sort of incentive, either money, attention, influence, such that you can entice them to participate. And that's basically what you need. Now, that's what you need to use these markets. If you want to test and validate them, then you'll, in addition, need some test period where you have a lot of fast questions you can ask to get a lot of data, some status quo thing to compare to. And that's, of course, the thing people have done in these experiments. I've been talking about this for many decades, and I just know that in most of your minds, you have a bunch of worries. You say, yes, but what about the following? And we don't have time in this presentation, fortunately, to go through these, but I wanted to put up a list of these so that you might realize that one of your concerns is up there. And of course, in Q&A or other discussions, I usually spend a fair bit of time going through these. Now, this is the cover of my latest book, The Elephant in the Brain, Hidden Motives in Everyday Life. And its key thesis is that all through our lives, we are just not very honest with ourselves about why we do things. And that's been an obstacle in prediction markets as we would try to apply them in business, because businesses pretend that they want more accurate forecasts on things. But honestly, a lot more things are political than they like to admit. And as a result, they don't actually want prediction markets when they are politically disruptive, which they often are. And unfortunately, I fear that's a key problem in academia. That is, we academics like to pretend that academia is structured so that we can produce intellectual progress. That's the point of what we do. So we like to pretend that people are rewarded on the basis of that and they are picked on the basis of that, et cetera. That's our story we tell ourselves. But honestly, it's just not as true as we like to think. Status markers in academia aren't really that different from status markers in the rest of the world. We like people who are powerful, charismatic, intelligent, et cetera, who are influential, who can do difficult things, and we do tend to pick people on the basis of that, and we do tend to let people affiliate with people on that basis. But we talk a game as if we were trying to produce intellectual progress. Now, so you know, my key story here is to say, if you actually wanted to produce more intellectual progress, you could do it through these markets. First, you could just create the markets, and that would produce more, accurate estimates, not only about who to hire, but about what the current consensus is on things. And you could subsidize those markets. So a key way you could provide science funding is by directly subsidizing these markets, say on the mass of the electron neutrino, which would then produce efforts to create more accurate estimates, which would then produce intellectual progress. So there's a wide range of ways, say, journals could use these. But, you know, as people have mentioned from many other journal innovation ideas, the key problem is journals like to publish sexy stuff. They want to pretend that they are also being rigorous and careful, but if you let them merely pretend but choose the sexy stuff, they will, and that's what they've been doing for decades by p-hacking, et cetera. And similarly, these prediction markets could allow them to produce, you know, choose the reliable things, the things that are likely to have influence, et cetera, but that may come at the cost of the other things organizations and individuals actually want to be doing here, which is mainly, I would say, producing and affiliating with status. And with that, I'll stop for now.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Robin. And please let us start with questions from the audience here. So, questions? Yes? Alistair?
Robin, you put up a nice list of the concerns that are most frequently expressed to you around this. What's the top of the list normally in your many deliberations, and what's your reply?
I think the top of the list is interfering with people's usual delusions or illusions. People have things they want to believe about their institutions, and then prediction markets often get in the way of that. They force them to admit. So, for example, in many organizations, when they put up a prediction market, one of the stories is, we're going to find the good people, the people who are insightful, who will do the best in these markets. And they do often find those people, but those people aren't actually the people they want to promote and raise in status, because they tend to not look like the high status people that people like to have be high status. They're often a corner. They're low level in the organization. Maybe they're not that socially adept. They just are really good at figuring out what the answers are. And so a key question is, are you willing to actually go with the answers the prediction market predicts, you know, advises? If it says that this guy who seems less impressive and less smart even is more likely to actually produce long-term intellectual progress, are you willing to actually choose that?
Yes. Further questions? Yes.
So you said you've been talking about this for 20 years. Have there been experiments actually testing it, and what are the outcomes? Or is it still theoretical, if you like?
Well, we've had many, many prediction markets over the years applied in many different areas, and all depends on what you think of the outcome metric.
So in science, sorry.
Right. If you want the outcome metric to be accuracy, they have proven themselves to be accurate, not just in science, but in elsewhere. As I said, we've had these prediction markets in various particular topic, you know, claims. We've had prediction markets in, say, the replication for lab experiments, psychology experiments. In terms of accuracy, the record is really quite reliable. What we don't have is people willing to actually put their organization at risk to make key decisions be made on the basis of the markets. That's the thing we have lacked so far. We've had some experiments with, like I said, with the presidential elections. We had some experiments in blockchain world where people have done these conditional markets that give people advice. But in most organizations, people have tried these for a while and then they've backed off because of the political disruption. That is, they've failed the politics test of playing nice.
Yes, Holger, yeah.
So I'm curious. I mean, people have been saying that there have been some rather spectacular failures in prediction markets. So I guess Brexit is a well-cited example. The Trump election is another one. Obviously, there must be something that has gone wrong then. And do you think that these kind of failures were just incorrect setups, incorrect mechanisms? Or do you think there's something deeper happening here?
So a prediction market produces, in those cases, a probability. And the way to evaluate a probability is in two standard metrics. One is called calibration and the other is accuracy. In calibration, these markets have been very consistently well calibrated for many decades. That is, if something says a 70% chance, then 7 out of 10 of those things turn out to be true and 3 out of 10 turn out to be false. So over time, these are very well calibrated. But of course, a calibrated metric is not necessarily very well informed. So given that they're calibrated, how accurate are they? And the only way to tell that really is to have large data sets and to look at the accuracy compared to other sources. So in all of those tests, the markets have done very well. Yes, of course, you can point to particular cases. In Brexit, for example, the market said it was a 15% chance. That means 1 out of 6 chances times it should be yes and 5 out of 6 chances should be no. It turned out to be a yes. Does that make the markets wrong? The only way you can really know is to have a large data set of these examples and to look at the overall accuracy. And in those tests, these markets have done very well.
Yes. Okay, I think that must be the final question, so we have more presenters. Thank you very much, Robin. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And I would like to invite the next speaker to the stage, and it's Professor Johan Bolden from Indiana University, and it's School of Informatics and Computing.
Oh, this is on, right?
Yeah. Okay, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so is my slide deck? Oh, I can hear my own voice. That's scary. My slide deck on? Okay, great. So what I wanted to talk about today, there's a laser pointer, great. Let's see. Yeah, so I wanted to talk about it today is an idea that came about during a rather drunken Christmas party at my place. So you got like 5 or 6 professors sitting around the table drinking way too much wine and beer, lamenting the difficulties we were having, or some of us were having, not me, in acquiring funding for our projects. And so this idea came up, you know, rather spontaneously, and the more we thought about it, the better the idea started to look. So
And this is not one of those cases where you get a little sauced up and you start writing poetry and the next day you look at it and it doesn't look as smart as it did the last night. This idea actually became a little better and better as we start to work out the details, and we actually did some simulations that showed that this might be a feasible way of doing it. Anyway, so let me give you a very quick overview of what how I think that science funding works in most established democracies, namely through a process of what could be charitably labeled hyper-competition. So the Congress makes a little bit of money available, and that money is then given to a funding agency, and then the funding agency thinks, well, we can only fund the best of the best of the best. We strive for excellence, only the excellent must be awarded. And then what they do is they have a bunch of investigators write proposals as if they're bidding for, you know, a kitchen renovation contract. And they make all kinds of promises, whisper all kinds of sweet words into the ears of the program director. And then, I'm being a little facetious. I love the funding agencies. I really do. But they assemble a bunch of reviewers, usually a panel of six or seven people, the Illuminati, that get together in a dark, smoke-filled room, and they look at the proposals. And then the proposals are ranked according to their excellence and their merits, and there's a whole bunch of administrative criteria, and then they're ranked. They're usually there's a couple of hundred, and then the top 10 or the top 20 get some money, and everybody else gets nothing, right? And then when the awards are being made, the money percolates down to the scientific community. So that's more or less, even though I'm being a little flippant, a little facetious about this, that's more or less how we award science funding. So a number of features of this is that it's project directed, right? So people submit proposals for projects, which means that there's a plan for what you're going to do, which I think is not very, which doesn't match very well how basic innovative research works. It's also hyper competitive. Proposals compete for funding. Few win and most lose. The focus is on peer review. We deem peer review of review panels to be the way of evaluating the best way to evaluate proposals. It's also auditable. This is the administrators and the lawyers like this, because you've got an administrative trail that says we looked at all of these and they were rated across these and these dimensions, and we added up the scores and these were the best and we gave them our money. It's also very accountable, which is important because there's budget priorities, there's the directives that you can include in the call for proposals. I mean, you can tell the scientists exactly what they're going to work on and then they'll make you a proposal for that. Anyway, so does that scale? No, it does not. If you look at the NSF and NIH budget combined, it's about $43 billion. The NSF received about 50,000 proposals in 2017, of which 11,000 were funded, and they conducted about 203,000 reviews of those proposals. The NIH received 54,220 proposals and 27,500 PIs. So that's not the proposal. These are the PIs were funded per year. And this is held steady. Well, I wouldn't say steady, but these are numbers between 2003 and 2015. The success rate of these proposals, and I know for most Europeans that sounds like science fiction, but it's a blissfully high 20%. I know you have funding systems like the Horizon 2020, which doesn't get even close to 20%. And so what you have is, over the past two decades, you've seen a growing mismatch between the number of applications and the number of people actually receiving funding. And that's very worrying, because it means that the system is simply not funding. It's getting more and more competitive, and it's becoming more and more wasteful as a result. So in terms of efficiency, Herbert et al. In 2003 did this analysis of the amount of time spent. So I've just talked about the funding agencies and how much time they spend reviewing and doing their jobs, right? But how about all of these scientists writing and submitting these proposals? Well, Herbert et al. Estimated that an average proposal took about 34 days of work. And for the whole of Australia, that's about 550 working years. That's 5.5 centuries of research time that was spent writing and submitting proposals. This is for Australia. The NSF received almost 50,000 proposals, as I said. Those are millennia of research time that are spent simply writing proposals about the research that you might conduct in the future if you receive the funding. Okay, so for me personally, it looks a little like this. A professor of computer science makes about $50 an hour. plus two colleagues. We have about 4 weeks of work to write a proposal. Never. I mean, we spend a lot more time writing proposals, but okay, 4 weeks, okay? Three co-PIs, 40 hours a week. Of course, we work a lot more, but okay, 40 hours a week times $50 an hour, $24,000. The NSF funding rate is one-fifth. Okay, probably not, but okay, one-fifth. Total cost of applying is about $120,000. If we have to apply multiple times to get for just operating at chance levels here. However, the average, okay, I just want to warn you, this is not a thorough financial analysis. Don't take these numbers home and complain to your local politicians. It's just a basic analysis. But I just want to let you know that the average NSF grant is $140,000. So depending on how good you are at writing proposals and getting them funding, your proposal should, your institution should probably not allow you to apply for funding. So is peer review reliable? Is it as good as we think it is? Is it the gold standard that we should hang all of our faiths upon? No, it is not. There's actually quite a bit of analysis that shows that peer review is actually remarkably poorly supported by the evidence with respect to its reliability and validity. In fact, one of the speakers, I forgot who it was, actually said that showed this quote, that if it were a medical treatment, it would probably be banned, not just for lack of evidence, but for evidence of its harmfulness. Is it fair? Well, the share of the first-time NIH awardees below the age of 36 has dropped to less than 5% over the past decades. So you have to be like pretty old. That's why I don't color my hair, because I'm hoping that all of this gray hair will eventually lead me to NIH success. Gender, this is something that we're all very concerned about, and yes, men do have statistically greater odds of getting funding, which of course is patently unfair. Innovation, strongest evidence indicates a bias against innovative research. So when you talk about excellence, I hate that word so much, really, and it's used everywhere by politicians, right? It's probably not a good idea. Peer review is biased against innovation. Okay, so then I've heard these things like, it's good for us. You know, okay, well, the cod liver oil, it doesn't taste good, but it's good for you. We should write proposals. Because these scientists and their scatterbrains, they should spend some time organizing their thoughts. Of course, through the means of proposals. But I'm not buying it. I mean, there's amazing pressure to apply for funding for early career researchers. In fact, in some countries, it's baked into the system where if you're a young professor, you cannot get that proposal, that promotion, unless you receive a grant from the national funding agency that is specifically geared towards supporting early career researchers, right? So think about that. So it's a little bit of a collusion between these two institutions. Promotion and tenure decisions may involve grants received, projects funded, etc. I can honestly say that Indiana University is blissfully enlightened about these things, and this has just seldomly come up in the promotion and tenure cases that I've been involved in. But the end result is an increasing workload for scientists as well as funding agencies. In fact, the Dutch NVO has a lot of foresight, and they were very concerned about what they call the aanvraagdruk, which means the pressure to apply and ways to alleviate it. But a lot of these things, in fact, a lot of the proposals that were made, honestly, in my book, look like just more administrative work and more barriers to researchers doing what they can do. Okay, so let's go back to basics, okay? So this is where I reveal my anarcho-syndicalist tendencies, and I'm just going to come straight out and tell you what I want. I want an ideal funding system to be cheap, low overhead, minimal externalities, okay? Easy decisions, low overhead. I want it to be community-based. I want everybody to collaborate rather than to compete. I don't like competition. I know over the past 20 or 30 years, we've become so enthralled. It's like this consensus trance that competition can be the only way through which we achieve good results. But I think in science, we should collaborate, not compete. I think it also needs to reward innovation to the maximum degree possible. And most of all, we need less peer review because it's proven to be damaging and very unreliable. So how do we do that? Well, let's start with the sort of the keep it simple, stupid system that I can come up with. You take the amount that's right now doled out by the NIH and NSF, about $40 billion. That's a lot of zeros, I know. $40 billion approximately. The U.S. has about 250,000 research professors. Divided, that's about $160,000 a year in my book. Is my math off? Perhaps by an order of magnitude, still good. Okay. Similar data has been shown by recent analysis by Vassen for Holland and a number of other countries. If you take the sums of money that the funding agencies distribute and you distribute it equally among all researchers, most of them will have enough for, you know, some summer salary, a student, a postdoc, and some equipment. It's not bad. Again, this involves nothing. Just send everybody a check. I like that idea. You know, if no, seriously, if people need money, then if you send them money, you've solved the problem. Simple. Okay, so moving on. okay, but of course, we hate equality. We cannot have equality. We must be unequal. We must compete for inequality, okay? So, yeah, this, I love that movie, by the way. It's 1984, right? It was released, the movie was released in 1984, and it has a great Eurythmic soundtrack. Anyway, so this is total equality. We don't want that. There's no merit components. There's no incentives. And waste also, not all researchers need $160,000, right? So can we improve upon this? We're going to do something super simple. We're going to make everybody a funder. So here's how that works. So everybody receives the same yearly base amount. Everybody may also receive donations from other scientists. So if someone likes your work, they should send you a little bit of the money that they receive. And then the requirement is that everybody must give a certain percentage of everything they receive. That means the base amount and what they receive from others to other researchers of their choice. Of course, this must be anonymous, and we must avoid conflicts of interest. And next year, we just go back to one. Everybody receives their base amount, right? They keep F percentage, and the other percentage they have to donate to other researchers that they choose. Super simple, could take about 10 minutes a year, and we're done. Okay? So I could see from the looks on your faces, you're not believing this. I know. You're not buying this at all, right? So here's the scenario. Let's say F is 50%. Katie receives the basic yearly grant of $100,000. She also receives $200,000 from her admirers. Her funding total is now $300,000. In that year, she could spend $150,000, but the other $150,000 she has to donate to other scientists for next year's budget. She logs into the funding agency system, enters the names of the scientists that she chooses. Of course, we're going to check for conflict of interest. And this is anonymous, of course. And there you go. Kati's done. And she can happily return to her research job. Okay, so that's pretty good. So how could this possibly work? The reason why this works is because it's based on a power iteration. We're essentially doing a power iteration with money. It's similar to Google's PageRank. So the funding circulates from one scientist to the next. And as such, what it does is it converges towards some kind of optimal distribution of funding that integrates the judgments of every scientist, not just the review panel. So here's the famous PageRank equation. You can see the first part, that's essentially each scientist gets a page, a baseline, that's 1 over n. And then the other part is, of course, the summation of the donations from other scientists, with the distinction that the F percentage will, of course, even though we all have to donate a certain fixed percentage of of everything we receive to other scientists, we can choose how much we give to every single one of them that we benight with our blessings. Okay, so I'm not going to go into this because I'm going to run out of time very quickly. The one thing I wanted to say is that, of course, some people will receive a lot of money because they're popular, everybody loves their work, everybody thinks they need the money. But that's a good thing because these people become like small funding agencies in of themselves, right? And so why would you give money to someone? Well, it could be because we admire their science, but we could also deem them to be good funders of science. We're going to think, this gal's got a lot of insight, and I'm going to send them my money so they can then donate it in turn. So that's kind of how the system works. We've actually done some simulations with this. We took about 37 million papers from the Web of Science, about 770 million citations, and then we looked at the grants received for about 110,000 researchers for the NIH and the NSF. So these were 347,000 grants for 110,000 researchers. So we knew how much every single individual received, but we also had a citation graph of the papers that they published. And then we made a simple assumption that people would apportion their donations according to their citations. I'm not advocating for using citations, but it's just an estimation in the simulation so we can estimate how much money would be given, someone would give to other scientists. And the results were very encouraging. In fact, if you look at the actual funding received through these individuals and how much they would receive under our system, there's actually a pretty good correlation. I know there's a lot of noise here. It's about Spearman's row is about 0.3%. So just using citations in this system, you could approximate very well, not very well, but to some degree, the funding distribution that we already have, right? So do you want more inequality, less inequality? You can actually vary the F percentage. If F is 1, it means you have to donate everything, which means that everybody is completely dependent on what they receive from other people, which leads to complete meritocracy. Okay, if F is very high, it means that if F is very low, that means you retain a lot of the funding, and you don't have to give so much away, and you end up with a more egalitarian system. perhaps mix that up, but you get the idea. Okay, so some requirements. I know you're thinking already, this will never work. People are going to give money to their friends. That's fine. They can give money to their friends. You know, it's supposed to percolate through the system. But it has to be anonymous. We probably have to check for conflicts of interest so your institution cannot force you to donate to people within your own institution. We need some management. The funding agencies can create some kind of a brokerage system for this. There's actually a way of actually carrying the donations forward computationally by repeating this cycle, but in a computational sense. There's various tunings that you can do. You can vary the donation fraction. The interesting thing is that, let's just say you have about 50% women in your system, and they receive only 30% of the funding, fix it. Just change the F or force people to donate more money to women or achieve some kind of a balance in their donations, and you fixed your inequality in the system. You can also have supernodes in the system, which people can where people can actually collaborate and form their own sort of group nodes or team nodes in the system, and then see how much money they can pool together to support that effort. Anyway, I think it's fair. Everybody gets a base amount, so young researchers do well. It's robust. Decisions are made by the entire community. It's also responsive. If priorities change, the community sort of collectively changes its priorities, then the distribution changes accordingly. But most importantly, we're not funding projects, we're funding people. And I think that's a very liberating thing. Possible effects in scholarly communication. If you're not open about the science that you do, if you don't go to conferences, you don't talk about what you do, you might not receive as much money. That's really good. I'm very open about what I publish. The reason for that is because I want people to read my research. I want people to know what I do. Okay, so I think that's good. More incentive to innovate, and now I'm being dragged off the stage because the Oscar music is going to start playing. A big thank you to my collaborators. Martin Scheffer at Wageningen University has really been pulling the card, as we say in Dutch, for this. And the Dutch NVO is actually, might actually give it a shot because they're working to organize at least a pre-study for a pilot that might involve some real money. So let's see whether the Dutch can pull it off. Thank you.
Super. Thank you so much, Johan. Thank you. We will have the questions at the end because now we have another presenter waiting online. And it's CEO and Chief Scientist Louis Rosenberg. And you are the Chief Scientist of AI and Unaminous. And it's a groundbreaking work Rosenberg does in the US. So let's listen to this. Welcome.
Great. Hello from California. Let me share my screen so I can put a presentation up. All right. So I'm Louis Rosenberg from Unanimous AI, and today I'm going to be talking about swarm intelligence and the power of hive minds. Now, let me start off with a very controversial statement in the world of AI, namely that people are smart. Every person in this room has about 85 billion neurons in your heads, and every one of those neurons is connected to thousands of others, which means there's over 100 trillion connections inside every human brain. It's the system formed by these interconnected neurons that make you who you are, not just your intelligence, your personality, your creativity, your values and morals. Every one of us is a complex system of neurons. It's remarkable. After all, we humans are pretty damn smart. We've created art, science, literature, The Simpsons. The question is, can we get smarter? And I'm here today to say that the answer is yes, if we use AI to amplify human intelligence rather than replace it. And that's really what we do at Unanimous AI. We connect people together in real time with AI algorithms to turn them into super intelligent systems. So let me start with a somewhat famous example. A little over a year ago, we were challenged at Unanimous AI by CBS Interactive to predict the Kentucky Derby, which is the biggest horse race in the US. And we weren't challenged just to predict the winner, we were challenged to predict the first four horses in order. Now, in horse racing, this is called the superfecta, and last year it went off at 540-1 odds. Now, I should say that at Unanimous AI, we don't know anything about horse racing. We had never done anything like this before, but we were game to apply our technology. And the way we start is the way we always start, which is with people. 20 horse racing enthusiasts. not experts, just enthusiasts, and not 1,000 people, just 20. And our process is to take these people, to connect them together with AI algorithms. We take real people, connect them together with AI algorithms, and we build an amplified intelligence. And this process is called artificial swarm intelligence, or swarm AI, because it's modeled after how swarms in nature amplify the intelligence of groups. Now, I'll come back to swarm AI in a second. I want to finish this story, which is we built this swarm AI system. We had this this intelligence predict first place, second place, third place, fourth place. We gave those insights to the reporter, which we would say are optimized insights, and she wrote a story, and then she actually went to the Kentucky Derby, and she placed a bet on the Superfecta, and she tweeted out her ticket, which put a lot of pressure on us. And the reason this became a famous story is that we got it perfectly correct. Anybody who had placed a $20 bet on those four horses would have won $11,000. I placed a $20 bet and won $11,000. The reporter placed a bet. A bunch of her readers placed bets. One of her readers reported winning $50,000. And that's pretty amazing. But what's actually more interesting is if we go back and we look at those 20 people, not a single one of them on their own got all four horses correct. In fact, had they taken a vote, they would have only gotten one horse right out of four. But when they worked together as a system, as an artificial swarm intelligence, they were perfect. So what is swarm AI? It's a process where we take networked human groups, people who have knowledge and wisdom and insight and intuition, and we connect them together with AI algorithms to build an artificial super expert, an expert that can generate more accurate predictions and forecasts and insights. And so how does it work? Well, I like to say it all goes back to the birds and the bees and fish and ants, because all of these creatures have evolved methods of amplifying their intelligence by thinking together in systems. This is why birds flock and fish school and bees swarm. They are smarter together than alone. Now, I'm not talking about crowdsourcing the way we humans do by taking votes and polls and surveys. I'm talking about forming systems, real-time systems with feedback loops that are so deeply connected that a new intelligence forms, an emergent intelligence with its own personality and intellect. I'm talking about forming a hive mind. Biologists refer to this as swarm intelligence, and it's a natural step in the evolution of most social species. So over the last 50 years, biologists have been studying swarm intelligence in nature, and it's really nature's way of amplifying the intelligence of groups. Now, what nature does not do to get the most out of a group of people or a group of organisms, nature does not take polls, conduct surveys, run focus groups. Nature also does not analyze big historical data sets. There's no big data in nature. Nature forms systems. Systems with feedback loops that allow groups to think together and converge on optimal solutions. And the group becomes smarter together than alone. So let's look at a natural system. How smart are swarms? The most famous swarm in nature is a honeybee swarm, and this is about 10,000 bees. And these 10,000 bees have a very difficult problem to solve. They need to find a new home to move into. Now, that new home could be a hole in a hollow log or the hole in the side of a building, or if you're unlucky like I was, it could be a crawl space in your garage. But this sounds like a simple problem, but this is actually a life or death decision that could impact the survival of this colony for generations. So how do they solve this problem? First thing they do is they send out hundreds of scout bees to search a 30 square mile area and find candidate sites. This is data collection. And the bees go out, they send bees out, they find dozens of candidate sites, and they bring that information back to the colony. And that's actually the easy part. The hard part is that they now need to pick the best possible site to move into. And it turns out that this is a complex multivariable problem because honeybees are very discriminating house hunters. They need to find a home that's large enough to store the honey they need for the winter. It has to be ventilated well enough to stay cool in the summer. It needs to be insulated well enough to stay warm on cold nights. It has to have an entrance that's small enough to block predators, but big enough to allow lots of bee traffic in and out. It needs to be waterproof so it's protected from the rain, but near water for bees to drink. And it has to be well located near a good source of pollen. To pick the best possible site is a multivariable optimization problem across all these competing constraints. A single bee could not possibly comprehend this. A single bee has a brain that's smaller than a grain of sand and has less than a million neurons. you have 85 billion neurons. So however smart you think you are, divide that by 85,000, and that's a honeybee. You certainly wouldn't want a honeybee picking a new home for you. In fact, if you were a human CEO or somebody running a big organization, you would have a very difficult time solving this problem or some similar problem, like finding the perfect location for a new factory or the perfect set of features for a new product or a perfect set of priorities for a political organization. It would be very, very difficult to find the perfect solution across all these competing constraints. And yet scientists have shown that honeybees find the best possible solution over 80% of the time. And when they don't find the best solution, they find the next best solution. So how do they do this? They do this by forming an intelligent system, that takes in noisy information about the world, data collection. They process that data together as a system, and they give out optimal solutions. Now I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, these are honeybees. How do they process data? It's actually pretty amazing. They do it by vibrating their bodies. Biologists call this a waggle dance, because to us humans, it looks like the bees are dancing. But really, they're generating signals that represent their support for the various home sites under consideration. And by combining these signals, the bees engage in a multidirectional tug of war, pushing and pulling on the system until they converge on the one solution that they can best agree upon. And it's almost always the optimal solution. Which brings me to the big question. If birds and bees and fish can get smarter together, can people form a swarm intelligence? And that was really the motivation for us to found Unanimous AI 4 years ago. And we discovered that the answer is yes, we can do it. We just need the right technology. And over the last 4 years, at my team, we've been studying natural swarms and how they amplify the intelligence of groups. And we've been developing the algorithms and interfaces that allow networked human groups to form swarms online. This is an artificial swarm. Each of those little magnets you see is controlled by a person logged in from somewhere around the world. And by pushing and pulling on the system, they're combining their insights in much the same way that honeybees do by waggle dancing. So how do swarms answer questions? Let me give you an example. So Newsweek challenged us to predict the Oscars every year for the last 3 years. And we start the way we always do, with people. So we start with 50 movie fans. We had them log in to our swarm system, just regular fans. And when they log in, questions appear on all their screens at the same time. Here's a question. Who will win best actress in a leading role? And then answers appear on all their screens at the same time. These are the different options. And then each participant can control a little magnet with their mouse or touchscreen or phone. And by controlling their magnet, they're expressing their will in real time. And AI algorithms are watching their behaviors and finding the optimal combination. So this is what it looks like with 50 people pushing and pulling as a swarm, with AI algorithms allowing them to converge on an optimal solution. In this case, it was Brie Larson. And we did the same thing for all the questions in the Oscars. Here it is again, who will win best actor? 50 people pushing and pulling, converging on an optimal solution. We gave those predictions to Newsweek, which published the predictions, put some pressure on us. So how did we do? Well, we can look at this in an interesting way. First, as individuals alone, this group was 40% accurate, just the individuals by themselves. We can also have them take a vote, which we refer to as a crowd or crowdsourcing. They got better. It was 47% accurate. So there is wisdom in crowds. But when they work together as a system, as a swarm, they jumped up to 76% accurate. That's almost double the accuracy of the individual member. And we can compare this with experts, professional movie critics, who are only 64% accurate in predicting the Oscars. What this means is that these 50 regular people, when thinking together as a system, outperform the New York Times, the LA Times, the Washington Post. In fact, we turn them into an artificial super expert. Now, you might be wondering about this year. There was another Oscars. We did even better. The swarm was 94% accurate. 50 regular people, 94% accurate in predicting the Oscars, better than Variety, LA Times, basically better than every professional movie critic. Here's one other study that was just published 2 weeks ago with Stanford Medical School, where we had a swarm of just 8 radiologists, and we had them work together to diagnose chest x-rays. And we ran this study, where we had a set of 50 chest x-rays. These 8 radiologists would diagnose them by themselves. We also compared to a deep learning system for diagnosing chest x-rays called ChexNet, and then we had the swarm. And so how did this swarm of radiologists do when we had them? And these radiologists were at different locations all around the U.S. They were working together. Chest x-ray popped up on their screen. They diagnosed the chest x-rays. How did they do? Comparing to the individual doctors, they were 33% more accurate. We reduced their errors by 33% when they were working together as a swarm intelligence as compared to as individuals. The other thing we did was we compared to a deep learning system. There's a system called ChexNet. It's the best deep learning system in the world for diagnosing chest x-rays with just a pure algorithm. And Stanford developed it, and they made news because they were able to replace human doctors with this algorithm. And our goal was to say, hey, well, what if we combine doctors together? Can we take the crown back for humans and allow humans to get better than this deep learning system? And we found yes. The answer was yes. This a group of eight doctors connected together by swarm AI technology was 22% more accurate than the most advanced machine learning system out there. And so what we can conclude here was that the doctors plus AI together perform better than the doctors or AI on their own. And so that brings me to the end of this presentation, where I really want to end where I started, which is that people are smart. We should not be replacing people with AI so fast. We should be looking at AI in different ways, because people have knowledge and wisdom and insight and intuition and opinions that that we don't necessarily appreciate as much as we should. But if we combine those insights, if we take network human groups and we connect them together with AI algorithms, we can turn groups of people into these artificial super experts. And those super experts will allow you to make more accurate predictions, forecasts, decisions, evaluations. And so in closing, I would say we should look to how we can use AI to amplify human intelligence rather than replace it. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Thank you very much, Louis. Questions from the audience? Yes. You need to, excuse me, the microphone.
Thanks. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, great. So I was just wondering, it's clear that the swarm AI for the x-ray detection was better, but then you had eight very expensive experts as opposed to a very cheap AI system. You could get many more benefits with the cheap AI system.
Yeah, that's a great question. And that's we're doing follow-up studies on smaller groups. So because eight was where we started, we think we can get very good performance with just three or four, but that's still more expensive. And so the ultimate scenario that we think will be very effective is basically a triage system. Because the truth is, for easy cases, the machine learning system is good at it. The machine learning system can get accurate results on easy cases. It's the difficult cases where taking a group of doctors and combining them will be the most effective. And so we imagine a triage system where a machine learning system can process the easy cases, and then it will know those cases where it's not giving high confidence, and that smaller set of cases could then go to a swarm of doctors, which could then process those and give more accurate results. And ultimately, it comes down to economics, which is if we can reduce the false positive rate. And that's really the problem with x-rays, is that there's a high false positive rate, which causes a really big expense in terms of extra procedures, extra tests. And so if we can reduce the false positive rate enough, it will more than pay for itself to have a small group of radiologists look at the more difficult cases.
Thanks.
Yes, okay, please.
Very fascinating. I'm curious, you must have thought about putting some AI systems into that swarm, right? I mean, you could add the deep learning system to the group of human experts. What happens if you do that? Do you get further improvements, or is that just not a good idea in the way you set things up?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And so the idea that we have this swarm of individuals, and we've been working on having a member of the swarm be a machine model. And that's definitely something that we can do. It turns out to be more difficult than, I mean, it's a great idea, and it's definitely something that will happen and should happen, but we need the machine model to behave in the way that a human does. And so we've been working on, can we take a machine model and have it behave, and so that a participant wouldn't necessarily know that it's a machine. But we do believe that it would be a good way to enable people to benefit from the output of a machine model. The other thing we can do, which is also really powerful, is just allow all the participants to see a printout of what the machine model might produce. We do predictions for elections, and what we'll do is we'll bring in a group of 50, you know, regular voters, but we'll show them the predictions that other machine models have generated, because then each participant is basically, they become a processor, right? Each participant is, they know their own feelings about the election, they know their neighbors, they know their family, and then they can also see what the machine model, and then they will aggregate that, and then each of them will then participate in a swarm. And that's really, you know, one of the reasons why a swarm is so different than, say, a poll. A poll treats a participant as a data point, whereas a swarm treats a participant as a data processor. It's treating them with more respect, and they're going to aggregate everything they know and then behave as part of a system.
Yes.
These are really very impressive data. I wonder whether you have been reflecting, what are the factors that can improve or deteriorate swarm intelligence? So, say, any advanced propaganda in one direction, or any alpha, whatever, having a certain opinion. There must be factors that influence swarm intelligence in both directions.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of factors. Some, you know, the first is to make sure that we ask questions that are clear. We want to make sure that everybody's interpreting the question the same way. If they're interpreting the question in different ways, then that could upset things. But that's true of it really, you know, polls or really anything where you're getting data from people. The other is that we've been looking a lot at populations. What types of people are the best participants in a swarm? Is it best to have experts? Is it best to have novices? You know, obviously we've done both. We've had swarms of radiologists and swarms of just, you know, movie fans. What we find is that the best people are the people who are well calibrated. They know what they know, and they know what they don't know, because the algorithms are looking at their confidence. It's looking at, you know, people have different levels of confidence and conviction. And so people who are really overconfident, they think they know way more than they really do, they're not effective contributors. And so we've been developing machine learning algorithms where we can actually identify those people who are just clearly overconfident, and we can reduce their influence. But it really comes down to if we have a group of people who are behaving in an authentic way, where they're really reflecting their true levels of confidence and conviction, we get very, very powerful results.
Yes, last question.
Well, he asked, he actually answered it.
So. Okay, yeah. Super. Yes. Final question, yes.
Hi. Just to pick up on something you were just saying about the type of question, I'm just interested to know if there are some that work better than others. And just because I love to talk about Brexit, the reason, a problem with that is that it's a very, very complex question. It's not a simple yes or no. It's not this one or that one. You know, it's got many, many elements to it. I'm just wondering how that influences it, and would this have been any better at sort of predicting that than something else, or would that not actually have worked very well?
Yeah, no, you bring up a great point, which is that if you ask a binary question as just a simple yes, no, you will get very distorted answers, because most people are complicated. People are complicated. They have mixed feelings, and what you really want to know is the strength of their conviction, not just yes or no, because that's what it all comes down to. And so we've developed methods of asking binary questions as a spectrum, so that we can extract from people their different levels of conviction. And we do that. We do a lot of sports predicting, because it's a great test bed, sports, because we can get results the next day. It's like an election every single day of the week. And sports are also binary. Who's going to win, team A or team B? but we ask it away in a way where the swarm can express different levels of confidence, and then we get aggregations that are very, very accurate.
Thank you so much for your contribution here today. It's really fascinating what you're doing. So thank you. And I'll hand to Louis Duesenberg. Thank you. Thank you. And the next speaker is Victoria Alsina from the Governance Lab, also research fellow at the Harvard School. Yes? Business, yeah?
Yes.
Yes. Welcome. Yes.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction, Karina. And I will continue with collective intelligence. And the starting point of my talk is that despite no special training in science, technology, or innovation, public officials need, are expected to make legislation and policies about it, right? And they need more than ever to use collective intelligence to get some expertise on those topics that move very, very fast. So this is my starting point. And the framework that I use and my research group uses to treat this is that basically two different elements. So the goals, the challenges that the public sector is facing nowadays are huge, and they need to collaborate to be able to solve them or to create public value in this context. And they need, of course, because these are very complex, they need to get the expertise of the public. And they need to have a role as conductors in an orchestra. And they need to learn how to get this expertise from the public. So this is the framework that we use as a must. And all this happens in a context where the citizens' trust in public institutions is decreasing every day. And this is a tendency that it is not linked to a concrete politician. It's something that it has been going on for the last decades around the world. So this kind of using collective intelligence is another source of legitimation and to try to improve this situation. So I will tackle two questions that were raised in the framework of this panel. The first one is, what new ideas exist for employing collective intelligence in ways relevant to policy? And here, what I want to say is that, of course, if we try to tackle this question, we can do better than voting. So this is the starting point here. And indeed, there are a lot of experiences around the world of public institutions that tried to move things forward, to move initiative, to be able to do this. We have different kinds of participation. We have direct democracy experiences, participatory budgeting experience, online consultation, citizen advisory boards, challenges, juries, online voting, public hearings. So the list is very long. But what they have in common, we have been reviewing a lot of them, and what they have in common are basically two things. That public institutions, they invest a lot of money and a lot of resources to promote these initiatives. And at the end of the day, the participation levels are low on average, and they have a reduced social impact if you compare what they have been doing and the resources that they invested through these participation processes. And we have been doing research, and we discovered that there are mainly three reasons that can explain this low impact. And this is one of them. So the participation processes that use collective intelligence have been focused too much normally in trying to get opinions and not trying to get the expertise of the people. So this is a first conclusion. A second conclusion is that they have been focused too much in improving the legitimacy of the process, and that it's good, but it's also necessary to focus on the outcomes and the quality and how collective intelligence can improve the quality of the resulting laws and policies. And the third conclusion here is that public institutions normally has focused too little in investing the proper resources that they need to digest all this information that they collect. So considering this, a couple of years ago, we started an initiative that we call the Crowd Law Initiative. We did this in the framework of the Governance Lab at the NYU Tandem School of Engineering. And what we are trying to promote with this initiative is basically promote a kind of participation that uses really collective intelligence and solve these three previous limitations that I mentioned. We define Crowd Law as the practice of using technology to tap intelligence and expertise, not only opinions of the public, in order to improve the quality. And we think that this can be applied in all stages of lawmaking. So this can happen in the problem definition stage. This can happen in the solution identification, in the drafting, in the voting, in the implementation, and even in the assessment stage. So because crowd law, like we understand it, is already happening around the world, the first thing that we did linked to this, it has been building what we call a crowd law catalog. We have been tapping and reviewing initiatives from all continents. And we built an online catalog where we compile all of those that we think that have some elements of this crowd law or potentially very easily can have them. And I don't have time now to go through all these examples, but we have been reviewing from the Beta Reykjavik platform in Ireland to B-Taiwan to parliaments and citizens in France, Mi Senado in Colombia, D3 in Australia, Promise Tracker in Brazil. So we have more than 100 in this catalog. We have been also promoting what we call the Crowd Law Manifesto, that basically it says is 12 statements that we wrote collaboratively with a bunch of scientists and practitioners from around the world. And we are trying to say collective intelligence is meaningful for public decision making. And we are trying to raise some principles that can be important to do that. We have been also developing a playbook. We understand this as a kind of manual, a guide with precise recommendations for public institutions that want to work on the implementation of participation processes, like I told, that compile expertise, not opinions, and focus on outputs and quality. And finally, what we are doing, because this is a very new field, we are doing what we call research into the wild. And we call it like this because, of course, it doesn't take place in a laboratory. What we do is that we partner with public institutions from around the world and try to do experiments with them using the platforms that they currently have, and using those platforms to do random control trials as much scientific as possible, considering that it's not a laboratory, of course, with the limitations that you may imagine, but trying to do this, to try different institutional designs and how the different institutional designs and the different ways that you use to compile collective intelligence can affect the quality of the policies. We are now developing a research agenda on that, and we understand this research agenda in three stages. So we want to understand individual behavior, how this affects to the information and the institutional knowledge that you can get through this participation, and finally, the social impact. So saying that, this is the webpage of the project, if you want to know more about what we are doing. And saying that, I want to use the last 3 minutes to present the second question that I want to answer that was raised in the framework of this panel, and is this one. And this question is just what we have been commenting in the last presentations, how artificial intelligence and this collective intelligence, understood in this case as public participation in decision-making, can interact and can reinforce one to each other. We have been starting to do this research this past year, and basically what we do is that we identify the different sources behind collective intelligence that make really special, this aggregation of knowledge and opinions. And we identified basically what we call 4 different powers: the power of aggregation, the power of deliberation, the power of collaboration, and the power of adaptation. And for each of these powers, we try to experiment how artificial intelligence can help complementing, some people mentioned this morning, and like also Luis was mentioning now, about, of course, not substituting, but complementing between them. The final objective of this, and we will have this ready by the end of this year, is what building what we call the democratic theory of artificial intelligence. Because we put this title as a provocative title, but we understand that there are a lot of debates going on about direct democracy, liquid democracy, representative democracy, and this deserves a special attention, and we created this as a category to open a debate and to promote research. Thank you very much.
Yes, and let's open up for questions from the audience. Yes. Yes, the speaker is up there.
Yes, if you come up to the
Yes, that's right.
I'm very in favor of implementing the system that you suggested.
Oh, great. Yeah, let's do it.
Yes. Yeah.
This was a great panel. I really enjoyed it. So my question is, I mean, I kind of feel that this is happening anyway on the Internet, maybe not very well, maybe a lot of bots involved, but somehow I'm a little worried about the anti-wisdom of the crowd, the at best stupidity of the crowd, at worst evilness of the crowd, and
madness.
I'm just wondering how. I mean, I understand what most of what you're talking about is all controlled, but I'm wondering how you can reconcile these kind of ethics issues. I mean, in the case of publication, there's a lot of issues about citations and, dead people getting increased money because their citations are growing and all that. So
yeah, I get you. I mean, about the citations, I was not advocating using citations at all. I want every single researcher to be able to make their own decisions. I mean, you're right. I mean, when you rely on systems like this, you have to be concerned about the madness of the crowd. But I mean, right now we don't seem to be very concerned about the madness of a four-person review panel, which is almost equally likely or almost assured. So, yeah, I do share your concerns, but I think these kind of systems are interesting because they compensate for their own behavior. These are dynamic systems, and the decision-making process is spread out across a number of autonomous individuals that are making their independent decisions anonymously. And so otherwise, yes. I mean, for example, if these donations weren't anonymous, I wouldn't be in favor of the system because it would become, you'd have rampant nepotism. But as long as it's anonymous, that prevents people from setting up, you wouldn't call them citation rings, but donation rings, right? And you'd have to put in good safeguards and make sure that the community is protected. But other than that, I think that this provides it. This gives you better odds of a good outcome that doesn't waste, 10 millennia of research time, people submitting proposals to funding agencies.
Yeah, up there first. Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I also like the funding scheme. Mm-hmm. Rachel Thomas from Simula, sorry. I like that you focus on funding people and that it's more open science that would be encouraged. But I'm wondering, it looked like it rolled over each year. What are the implications for long-term research?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a good question. It just depends on how you set up the system. It's perfectly possible, for example, for the system to have slush funds, super nodes, et cetera, to allow people to store some money away. I mean, you'd have to do some accounting. You'd have to look at how much you're receiving and how much you're planning to spend. Nothing prevents people from making appeals to the scientific community and asking for persistent donations, et cetera. But donations are voluntary, so you'd have to work with the community to support your efforts.
Hi. Both of the concepts and actually the panel is really, really interesting. I have, a question for you about this sort of crowdsourced funding model. I see a slight challenge, and maybe you can allay my fears with this, but what would you do with nascent markets or nascent research areas that are emerging? What you probably would find, I would assume, is that a lot of researchers would probably fund things that they understand, the areas that they understand, and that they can verify whether that research is of good quality or that the topic is worthwhile doing. But when you have nascent markets or research areas that are developing, people will understand them less, so people are probably less likely to fund them, and therefore, do you not just propagate a system where the most dominant markets or research areas continue to be dominant and continue, and then you end up having a sort of status quo that never changes?
I mean, you make a good point, but the thing is that the way that the system operates is that there's a baseline level of funding that every individual researcher receives, right? That's very different from what we have now. If you're part of a nascent market or a nascent domain, you have to apply for funding from review panels that have been shown to be very conservative and very adverse to innovation. So I think the situation would overall still be better than what we have right now. But I agree with your concern is that when you're part of a nascent area, you'd better be very public, very open about it, and advocate your position as widely as possible. But it's very easy. It's also very low risk for someone to send you a couple of $1,000. If enough people think that, oh, it's low risk, I'll send a small proportion of my donation to this group, then you know, it could really stack up. So I think your odds are much better under this system if you're part. I mean, the challenges will always remain, but I think you have much better odds of supporting your research under this system than you do under the present system, which is very aversive to innovation, in spite of all of the promises and the bon mots that are being exchanged.
So I like the system a lot. Nevertheless, I need to play devil's advocate here. I mean, you point out correctly that in the current system, people are wasting tons of time, you know, not just preparing grant proposals, but also reviewing them, right? And that wasn't even factored into your little calculation, so that makes it even worse.
Yeah.
I think in the new system, as devil's advocate, I would say people will spend as much time advertising themselves to an anonymous crowd, and it will become this popularity contest, right? Which I'm not necessarily saying is a bad thing. I'm just wondering, how do we really know that it's going to be so much more efficient and that people are not just incentivized to turn into hopeless, shameless self-marketers, because that will give them enough draw. You know, some people won't like it, of course, and will withhold, but enough draw to just outperform in that funding scheme.
I share that concern because, perhaps it's also part of the academic sort of environment that I come from, which is very much focused on training citizen scientists. People are willing and capable of speaking out about their ideas, right? But I mean, come on, we're here in Oslo, right? The whole purpose of a good chunk of our time is invested in communicating with our colleagues, talking to our colleagues about our ideas, exchanging ideas, telling them about what we think is worthwhile. This month alone, I was away from my institution for at least 3 weeks, going to the Complex Systems Conference in Thessaloniki. I was at the Santa Fe Institute before. It's not because I'm a shameless promoter of myself, but it's simply that's part of the job of communicating to the public and my colleagues about my research. And so that is a natural part of our activities as scientists, which in this case also serves, under this system, also serves the double function of informing the community about where they can put their money. So, yeah, I agree with you. There's a thin line between shameless self-promotion and sort of a natural communication that's part of science. But I think what this system does is it takes something that we already do and then uses it for to save some time elsewhere.
Two questions more, and then we will get going. Yes, Morten?
Yes, I should also play the devil's advocate to you, John, but I'm going to be a more tabloid than Holger was. I think we are in a situation where the rest of society has an image of scientists as having a strong sense of entitlement. And this send me the check image is not a very good way of communicating to the rest of society that you take well care of their money. It's like in the ads that says, because you deserve it. No, and
I love those ads.
Yeah, but I'm watching those ads, I guess. Dear neighbor, just give me the money. The question I have is: it's very interesting with the crowd, this crowd methods. We can use it for so many things, but society has the right to have an opinion, and this crowd method you're proposing is very. You know, who's member of the crowd? And politically, that would be the failure of the system if you cannot involve the legitimate opinions of the society around us.
No, I agree. I honestly feel that... I feel very strongly, in fact, of communicating with the public and the public communicating with science. I mean, it should be a two-way street. But we should be careful. And science really needs autonomy to be productive,
we don't have
to be innovative. And so there's a little bit of a tension between societal responsibility and groveling to the public. And the advantage of the system that I'm proposing is that the public can participate very easily. You could very easily have people vote or participate in the vote on how funding should be distributed. It would be relatively straightforward to change the parameters for certain domains, so certain domains are favored over others. So there's ways to build accountability into the system that extend well beyond what is presently provided under the funding system, where if the public knew how these decisions were being made and the amount of money that was wasted on administration, that doesn't lead to scientific innovation, but it just serves the interests of the requirements of funding agencies and administrators, there would be much... They could, I mean, their response might be much less favorable than it would be if you allowed them to participate in the system. I mean, think about this, right? If you're telling your average Norwegian potentially that about 20% of their taxpayers' dollars in Norway don't go to the science, but they actually go to proposal reviewing and paper pushing and administrating and filling out forms, etc. That's not a very good. If they knew, I think that would irritate them. It's a little bit like a charitable. Organizations that turn out to use 10 or 20% of the money that people give to them for charity and use it for their own administration. That would not be looked upon very well. This system, it's actually relatively straightforward to allow the public to participate, and I think we should. Industry could participate as well. Google has $1 billion, they can just drop it into the system and it will just percolate.
Johan, we will have the last question.
Sorry, yes? So I do have a question for Johan, but I'm going to save it for coffee because Victoria hasn't gotten many questions.
Exactly.
Oh.
And I would like to also ask her. So I worked in the U.S. Senate for Senator Bill Nelson as a science advisor under the AAAS Fellows Program. And as a scientist, it was very hard for me to learn how to write good legislation, right? Because they're worried about not being too prescriptive to the agencies. They're worried about how the law might be interpreted and could end up in the courts, right? And so I would sit there in meetings where they literally argued over single words. For weeks about how to include it and the intent of Congress. So I'm curious. A colleague of mine built a serious game called Budget Hero, and it allowed the public and students to play this game and balance the federal budget. And there I can see incredible value to engaging the public in that decision-making, and then they understand that it's not a zero-sum game. They have to balance things. But when you're coming to legislation, have you done comparisons of legislation that's been crafted by, quote-unquote, the professionals, which is usually some 25-year-old staffer, but versus crowd-created legislation and how it's interpreted in the courts and its impact or negative externalities?
Yes, the answer is yes, and I have good news for you, because we did the experiments at the local level. So we didn't do it at the regional or national level in parliaments, but we did it in city councils. We did it in Madrid, in Spain, and we will do it in New York. So we are working on that, and this is part of the research agenda. And the results, to be true, the ones that we have from Madrid now, are quite good. I mean, it really improves the quality of the final law that you have, or the policy, depending on the case. The good news is that we will start doing experiments with the U.S. Congress in a couple of months.
So
we can talk about it in the coffee break.
Yes. Do we have just a final question for Alessina, Victoria, Alessina? No. So thank you so much. And we have raised the debate here today. So that was great. Thank you so much.